Hey, welcome to the Film Podcast. I'm Ricardo.
And I'm Eric.
And today we are doing our part five of our canon film series. Man, it's taken a while, but we're getting to the fun films, right?
We struggled
in the beginning just because, man, some of those first ones were hard to get through.
But starting with
American Ninja, we're gonna have a lot of fun, and it's gonna take us all the way through the end of all these films because we got a lot of good ones coming up.
Looking at the upcoming list, I think we're getting to release dates of stuff that came out when video stores really started to come on the scene, and so there was an audience for the more off the wall, do what you want kind of stuff, whereas the earlier stuff was pitched towards drive-ins and maybe the beginnings of cable television and the early days of the video store. But by 84, 85, the video store really comes into the American landscape. So
yeah. And if you don't know, if you're new to the podcast and this is your first episode, well, we'll give you a little background on what this is. First of all, if this is your first episode, maybe try going back to the Canon Films Part One, and it'll explain to you. But here we go. This is the quick version. We are covering most of the Canon Film Group's catalog of films. The Canon Film Group was an American company formed by Menahem Golan and his cousin Yoram Globus. They basically produced like these really fun indie, quirky films. Some of them actually, you know, turned out really serious and really fun. But we're covering all their catalog, and so far we've done The Apple. We've done some crazy films already. Ninja 3: The Domination. We did The Apple. We've done a bunch of movies so far. So this is part five, and this episode we're gonna be covering The Company of Wolves. Where are we at? Let's see. The Company of Wolves. Rapping. Life Force and American Ninja.
Yes.
So usually we do 3 to 4 films per episode, and yeah. So I'm excited. But first, you have some news, right? About a canon.
Yes, we
canon
got
news. Yeah.
So to begin with, one of our early episodes, we covered. In fact, it was episode number 2. We covered the film Treasure of the Three Crowns, which I liked more than Ricardo did. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of an Indiana Jones-esque adventure film that was only available on YouTube. Tomorrow, Shout Factory is releasing a 4-film set called the 4 Action Adventure Movie Marathon that includes Treasure of the Four Crowns. You can get it right off their website for $9.99. The other films are not canon films. And to be honest, the only one I know is called The Final Option, which is a British action film from 82. But if you want to check out Treasure of the Four Crowns, this is a good way to do it. I have several of the 4 movie sets from Shout Factory. They do a great job, so that's highly recommended. Anybody wants to check that out?
Yeah. And a great company to buy from. Shout Factory puts out some great DVDs. Some like gems that are hard to find on Blu-ray and stuff, or even like hard to find on DVD. They're kind of putting out some great stuff.
They also have their Scream Factory line, which is deluxe Blu-ray reissues of great B films and horror films. In fact, that's where the Ninja 3: The Domination Blu-ray is from. And there is actually a new podcast out there, a relatively new podcast called the Screamcast, where they cover all of the Scream Factory releases, and our friend Brian Sauer is one of the frequent hosts of that podcast.
Yeah, he just got added as a regular host on there, I think, right?
Yes, so it's well worth checking out what they're doing. Basically, they're doing I guess it's safe to say, the Criterion Collection for horror and science fiction films.
Yeah.
So, in fact, one of the films we're going to be talking about today, Life Force, they did a Blu-ray of, and not to get too ahead of ourselves, but that's definitely something I'm looking to pick up in the future. So,
yeah.
That's our first bit of news. And speaking of the Criterion Collection, our second bit of news is In episode 3, we skipped one of Cannon's films, Love Streams by John Cassavetes, because it wasn't available.
Yeah.
However, Criterion will be releasing it on a dual format Blu-ray and DVD in August. The release date is August the 12th. So previously we talked about, as things become available, maybe going back and catching up with them. And this is definitely one that I would like to catch up with eventually.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of these out-of-print ones or hard-to-find ones, some, I mean, there's always a way. You could always find it. Like, I know Love Streams was in, you could watch it in pieces on YouTube. But, yeah. You know, you always want the DVD, and you always want the special features, and especially if there's, like, a commentary track. You want all those extras. And it's great that Criterion kind of stepped up and picked it up.
And it looks like it's an example of, while Canon was releasing, you know, B films, action films, drive-in fare, at the same time they were using some of those proceeds to invest in, you know, auteurs like Cassavetes, to give films that deserved an audience or deserved to be made. I mean, we talked about that Championship Season previously, which was a more art film. It was based on a play. Yeah. That all of this ninja stuff and horror stuff, a lot of that funded these more artistic prestige films like Love Streams.
Yeah, yeah. And is this officially Criterion's first Canon Films release?
You know, I do not know that offhand, but I would not be surprised if it is.
Yeah,
because I cannot think of any other Canon films that wound up on Criterion.
I feel like if something was out from Canon, I would have at least heard about, yeah, or at least bought it, because I do love me some Canon. Even if it was a movie I hated, I might consider buying it just because, yeah, it's Canon Films. All right.
Just one more piece of news.
Yes.
And that is, we have talked about the upcoming documentary Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films.
Yep.
And they're actually premiering it at the Melbourne International Film Festival on the 2nd of August. And we'd love to go see it, but not going to make the trip to Australia, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So anybody in Australia, Morris, take the opportunity to go check it out. Let us know. It's directed by Mark Hartley, who did Not Quite Hollywood and Machete Maidens Unleashed, which are both great documentaries about B films from different regions. So the expectation is that Electric Boogaloo is going to be, hopefully, in that range. And looking at the talent and the people that worked with Canon that he has gotten interviews with, it promises to be a great film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so if you're out there, you happen to be on vacation or something, and you're a movie lover, you should definitely check out that documentary if you have access to, you know, to being out there and stuff. I can't wait for it. I can't wait for them to announce the release date, or, you know, a theatrical release date, because I will definitely be checking that out. I'll probably make the film festival round. I think that's the first festival it's opening at. So we'll probably, you know, it's early on in the film festival year. So we'll probably be seeing a lot of festival runs for that documentary. So
yes, I wouldn't be surprised if it plays at TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival, in September.
Yeah,
that would seem like a likely place for it to play.
Yeah, and we should have links to all this stuff on our website at thefilmpodcast.com. All right, so The Company of Wolves is a film directed by Neil Jordan, and Neil Jordan, this falls, I think this is his second film. He had filmed a movie in 1982 called Angel. And this is from 1984, The Company of Wolves. And Angel started his kind of collaboration with Stephen Ray,
mm-hmm,
which continues until this day. I think he in most of his films, he's cast Stephen Ray. But for the people who don't know who Neil Jordan is, he is, he's done a ton of films. Basically, the most popular ones you would know is probably, everyone's probably seen this, Interview with the Vampire. But most famously, he did The Crying Game, which is a great film from 1992. But everyone, I feel like everyone's seen Interview with the Vampire. So I guess you would know him from that. But he did. He also did In Dreams, The End of an Affair, The Good Thief, Breakfast in Pluto, which is crazy, with Cillian Murphy. I found that movie kind of interesting. The Brave One with Jodie Foster, Odine. And then he did another vampire movie with what's her name? I forget. I can never pronounce her name.
Saoirse Ronan.
Yeah.
Damn, I absolutely love. She's an amazing young actress.
She's amazing. And Emma Edgerton. And it's kind of like a weird. It's like, to me, it felt like a weird follow up to Interview with the Vampire, even though it has nothing to do with those characters. But it just felt like a spiritual sequel to it.
Yes, in a lot of ways. And I actually watched that Byzantium around the time that I watched In Company of Wolves. Rewatched In Company of Wolves.
So the Company of Wolves. It's a strange little film. The movie is set kind of in modern times, or modern times meaning the 80s when it was filmed.
Yes.
And it takes place within the dreams of Rosalind, who's played by Sarah Patterson. And she's a young girl, and she kind of like falls asleep, and the whole movie kind of takes place within her dreams, which is pretty crazy. It's got some interesting sequences. It's got like Terrence Stamp as the devil, but basically at its heart, it's kind of like Little Red Riding Hood, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's kind of Little Red Riding Hood meets a werewolf film with overtones about girls going through puberty.
Yeah. And I read one of the trivia things I read was that originally had more like sexual undertones, but then when the lead girl was cast, she was underage, so Neil Jordan went in and took out a lot of the sexually, you know, suggestive stuff, because of her age. But it felt like originally they wanted to make more of a kind of what Cannon was into then. Like it was a horror sexploitation film that kind of. Once that lead was cast, they kind of rearranged to be more of a horror film than anything.
Well, and it's a very arty horror film as well.
Yeah. Well, Neil Jordan's always been he's very art house, an art house type of director. But he also co-wrote the script. He co-wrote the script with the author of the short story it's based off of, which is also titled The Company of Wolves. And it was a short story, and also she adapted it into a radio play, I think. And then eventually Neil Jordan got his hands on it, and he with the author of the book adapted it into a screenplay. I think the author of the book is Angela Carter. So if you're interested at all in reading her short story, you could find Angela Carter, The Company of Wolves. But basically, like we said, a very artsy kind of a modern retelling of Little Red Riding Hood. Do we need to go into more synopsis? That's pretty basic.
Well, I don't think so. It is kind of episodic, and it is kind of non-linear in some ways. And that's all part of the dream structure, because that's how dreams are.
Yeah.
The horror is, you know, there is a certain amount of gross practical special effects that are very effective, that are visceral, but that also fits right in with kind of the fantasy dreamlike element of the film.
Yeah, you know, I did like that part of it, that it was very chaotic, like dreams tend to be. Like it didn't stay with one narrative. It wasn't like a complete narrative. It kind of jumped around at parts. What's her name is in it? I forgot to mention. Angela Lansbury plays the granny, the grandmother.
Yes.
And Stephen Ray plays a young groom who you find out is a werewolf. There's a huntsman. There's a lot of... So this movie came out in 85, and I think American Werewolf came out in 1981?
Right. 81, 82, somewhere in there.
Around 82. And there's some similar type of effects with, you know, the turning of the man into a werewolf. But these done a little bit more grotesque. Like, I feel like there's a lot of things you don't see in American Werewolf in London that your mind fills in, and it's even creepier. Where here you're kind of seeing more. You're seeing more blood, more gore. And I don't mm-hmm. know if it helped, or I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. It's definitely some stuff was really creepy when he tears his face off. At one point, Stephen Ray, let's. She has a dream. She's dreaming of her. You see, like Little Red Riding Hood with her granny, and she's telling her a story. And it flashes back to a groom and a wife. It's their first night together.
Their wedding night.
Yeah, yes. Their wedding night. And before they consummate the marriage, he opens the door to throw out what is that creature he has? Like, it's like a, not a porcupine. It's like a guinea pig hedgehog. Or something. It's weird. It's a weird creature.
Like a hedgehog.
Yeah, like a hedgehog. And he opens the door to toss it out from their cabin. And he, like, the moon catches his eye or something, and you can never really tell what he's looking at, but something catches his eye outside, or you know, something in the air, and he says, "I have to go for a bit," and she says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Well, nature calls," and it's kind of like a double meaning because I mean, clearly he's a werewolf; you could see it in his eyes turning, and he takes off for 3 years.
Yep.
So 3 years later, he shows back up. You know, he says nature calls. He's gonna go pee, and he leaves. Comes back 3 years later, and she's now gone on. There's a funny line that says Granny says a funny line that she says she eventually married someone else who wasn't embarrassed to like piss in a chamber pot.
You know who that somebody else was? You know who the second husband is?
Who was the second husband? Who was it?
Is an actor named Jim Carter. Who is best known for playing Mr. Carson on Downton Abbey.
Really? I've never seen that show. So, yeah. Oh, wow. That's very... I have to tell my girlfriend. She's gonna,
I saw him, and I'm like, I know that guy from somewhere. And I looked it up, and I'm like, sure enough.
That's so funny.
He's in Downton Abbey.
she marries this... Basically, the man who becomes the huntsman. A lot of these characters don't have names. I noticed that.
Yeah.
Just like young bride, young groom, mother, huntsman. The only people that really have names are like Rosalind and like Alice are the only two people that have names, which are the two sisters. So he comes back 3 years later, and she's now married to the huntsman. And they have, I think, two kids. Mm-hmm. And he comes in, and he's like, "I'm terribly hungry. Feed me." And she's like, and he's like, "Where are these offspring from? Like, you know, like, where do they come from?" And my favorite line is, she's like, is that the Stephen Ray's like, "You're a whore," basically calls her a whore. And he's like, "If I was a werewolf, I'd kill you right now." And then he proceeds to like try to like attack her. She reaches for boiling water, splashes it on his face. His face starts burning, and he begins to tear his face apart. Which is where the effect of him transforming into a werewolf starts, and like I said, it's a little gory. Like they went full out. Like, first of all, he starts peeling the skin off his face, which reveals like just his muscles, like just all the skin's off. You see the muscles even stretching on his face, and then eventually, his human face starts turning into a werewolf. And there's some interesting effects in this. There's two movies that we saw in this grouping of films. This and Life Force had really interesting effects.
And these were state of the art for the time in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah. I was definitely amused with like, so eventually he full on turns into the werewolf. And is about to attack the bride and her kids when the huntsman comes in and chops his head off. And there's an interesting shot that it's funny. I saw this film when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I remember watching this and really it really kind of scarring me. And for this specific scene, the huntsman chops off his head, and the head flies off and lands in what looks like boiling milk, that's the best way I could explain it, because it's not like a soup or anything, because it's white. So the wolf's face gets chopped off, head, sorry, and the head lands in this like pot of like boiling milk. It goes in, and you see it's like slow motion. You see the werewolf head go in, mm-hmm. and then what? And it's in the same shot. What comes out, like what floats back out, is Stephen Ray's face, which is a really interesting in camera effect that I really really dug. I'd be curious to see how they did that. And that to me as a kid was like the scariest thing ever. I'm like, dude, like he, what's going on here? That's the thing that when I saw that we were covering this film, I'm like, oh fuck, I'm gonna have flashbacks of me freaking out as a kid after this scene. But then it gets really crazy from here. Like Terrence Stamp shows up as the devil,
driving a big old car in the woods.
Yeah, and which is weird because they're in what time period do you think this takes place?
Oh, it's supposed to be some kind of medieval fantasy time period.
And here comes
what I got from it. It's very.
And here comes Terrence Stamp in like an old like old timey car.
Yeah.
And he's holding a skull like Hamlet is, and he makes a deal with this kid, and it's a really weird film. Did you enjoy it? Had you seen it as?
I saw it when I was younger, and I really didn't get it, and I didn't remember a whole lot about it. I did enjoy it. I don't know that it's a quote unquote fun film, but it's definitely arty.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the kind of dream logic of it, and the performances are all good, and it's got a great look. Although the production values are very much like a TV movie of the era.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a little hokey in places, but overall, I thought it was a good film, and I liked it, and I think people should check it out. And I think it's interesting. There's kind of a thread with werewolf films with girls that, you know, the classic werewolf male films are about men not being able to control their beastly nature, where with girls, these films seem to be about puberty and getting their first period and those kinds of things. There's a film called Ginger Snaps that was made in the 90s that deals with this. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah. It starred, it's the girl with the crazy
something
eyes.
Or other. I can't remember her last name.
Yeah.
And that's actually coming out from Scream Factory in this summer sometime. But those are films that definitely deal with the animal nature in women when they go through puberty. I think this is one of the early examples of really dealing with that in a more frank kind of a way.
Yeah, yeah. Ginger Snaps. I forgot who the girl was thinking about, but it's Emily Perkin. Mimi Rogers is in it.
Yeah.
It's a pretty interesting film. And I, now that you remind me, yeah, there are very similar tones about that, about a woman coming into her, a girl coming becoming a woman and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I could totally see that now. It's funny how I totally forgotten about Ginger Snaps. I did enjoy the whole like fantasy dream aspect of this film, and in that way it does work. I don't know if, like you said, like if it holds a lot of entertainment value or if it even holds up at all. Like I remember being scared of it as a kid, but after rewatching this just recently, I don't know if. I don't know if it holds up. I don't know if somebody who's just seeing it for the first time will get any entertainment value out of it, or if they'll just think it's kind of hokey, you know.
So there's a podcast out there called The Faculty of Horror that's two women who talk about horror, and they have kind of they're academics, so they're coming from a university point of view,
yeah.
And they definitely have a feminist slant on it. On their watching of horror films, it'd be interesting to hear them talk about this. And I believe also that the Feminine Critique podcast covered this a while back.
I'd be curious to hear their take on it.
Which is two women who are horror fans talking about horror films.
Yeah, yeah. It, which is also a great, really great podcast. I've heard some of their episodes.
Yes, for me there is a. You know, I think it's worth seeing, but especially want to hear what women have to say about this film.
Yeah.
And looking at it from a historic point of view, if, you know, someone like Faculty of Horror would go back and maybe match it with something like Ginger Snaps and talk about how it does or doesn't hold up. So that Feminine Critique episode was number 32, where they covered both Company of Wolves and Byzantium. So if anybody's interested in checking that out.
Yeah, yeah. Check that out, and we'll have a link on our website again for that if you don't want to write it down right now. So how much did you enjoy rewatching this, or did you enjoy rewatching it?
I did enjoy rewatching it, and I think that it's a more mature film than I definitely appreciated as, you know, as a 15-year-old or whatever when I saw it.
Yeah.
And, I don't think this is the film that you're going to sit around with your friends and, you know, have a couple beers and whatever, but it is part of a continuum of treating horror seriously and producing interesting work using the tropes and the mythology.
Yeah.
You know, there's another film that I'm a big fan of, Hannah. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, with Saoirse Ronan as well, yeah. That deals with mythology, and not mythology, but folk tales. And that's definitely, this film's definitely playing with that as well.
Yeah. Who directed that? It's a big director. Is it Stephen Frears or so?
Joe Wright, I believe.
Joe Wright, yeah, yeah, yeah. He did
Atonement, and yeah. I've not seen his, I think it's Anna Karenina that he did next.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I really dug Hannah. I really dug.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Eric Bana, Joe Wright, So, Atonement, I wasn't a big fan. I was a big fan. I love, like, the first 30 minutes of it, yeah. And then it loses me.
Okay.
But here's the thing about Joe Wright. He has some great, like, long takes. And Hannah has an amazing fight scene with Eric Bana. That's one long take that I really, really love. I always look forward to his long
takes. Yeah, and, I love his use of nature and the way he shoots people. And,
yeah.
That he uses, like, a kinetic long take action scene, but then you have scenes of them just in the desert or in the snow-packed wilderness or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And again, all the entire cast of that film is really great. So yeah you definitely check out Hannah. But this wasn't a chore to watch, but definitely I was like, at times I was like, I wish I could check my phone, but I won't.
This is the more thoughtful film that you sit down with your more arty film inclined, academic inclined film fan friend, and you watch it and then maybe have a glass of wine and talk about it. Like I said, I really would like to hear what the Faculty of Horror would say about this film.
I'd be interesting to hear just a woman's point of view of this film.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would love to live in a world where teenage girls are discovering this, but I'd be happy if they discover Ginger Snaps.
Yeah, yeah. That's a fun film.
It is a more accessible film. Yeah, yeah.
I found out doing the research for this film that apparently Neil Jordan wanted Andy Warhol to play the devil. He wanted him to have a cameo as the devil, and eventually the part went to Terrence Stamp, but because Andy Warhol, I think he had just been shot around that time, and he feared for his life if he traveled. So he said, "I'll shoot the scenes if we stay in New York," and they just could. It was impossible to film in New York. So the part went to Terrence Stamp instead. So, all right. So, what did you rate this film? As always, we do our Letterboxd score. 1 to 5 stars, half stars count. What did you give the movie, Eric?
I give it 3 stars.
3 stars. Nice. It's a nice middle of the road good score. I gave it 2.
Okay.
There's a lot of films that are coming up in the Canon film series that I gotta have room to go to. I gotta be able to hit my 4s and my 5s. There's definitely a 4 in this group of films that we're covering. I finally get to a 4-star film. But The Company of Wolves, 2 stars, definitely artsy, good effects, great acting. Production value, not as great as some of their other films. But overall, you know,
At the same time, I would say with that production value, it is a product of the time, and while it might look dated, it also is an artifact of that time.
That's true. That's true. But definitely, like you, I think you mentioned, it has a little bit of like a TV quality. It's not quite. I mean, for its time in '84, like we had seen a couple other werewolf films that had some great production value. So it's fine. It's an artsy werewolf film. We'll say that. For it being that, I guess the production value was okay. But again, it's interesting seeing Angela Lansbury as Granny. It was pretty fun. I was like, oh wow, totally forgot she was in this. Same with Terrence Stamp. I forgot he was in this as well. But again, 2 stars for me. Eric gives it 3. So check that out. If you want to follow us and see what we've scored all our canon films, I have a list up under my profile. You can follow us on Letterboxd, LetterboxD.com. Just search my name or Eric's, and you'll find our profile. All right.
Yes.
So that concludes The Company of Wolves. And our next film is what are we doing next? Rapping?
Rappin' from 1985, released on May 11th, 1985, directed by Joel Silverberg. And basically, this is Breakin' 3. It's a spiritual sequel to Breakin' 2. It's kind of like they started to refine the, what do you want to call it? The cliches or the plan, how they were going to make these films
The
follows
formula, the formula.
formula. Thank you,
Yes.
thank you. It follows a character played by Mario Van Peebles, who's called John Hood, who just gets out of jail and heads back to the mean streets of Pittsburgh. I believe it's Pittsburgh anyway.
I think it
It's
is.
and that's one of the things about this film that I will give it is that it does show a regional city in a time and a place that we didn't see a lot of. So anyways, he gets out of jail. He goes back to his neighborhood where he's trying to keep his nose clean and stay out of trouble and reconnect with his girlfriend. And of course, the local hoods want to pull him back in. And it really turns into a Save the Rec Center, which is really the Save the Neighborhood film.
Yeah, which was the same kind of plot line to Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo. And like you said, this was definitely a spiritual sequel to those films. In fact, I'd say there's more dancing in this than there is rapping in this movie.
Well, and this is considered to be of the break-in. If you add the break-in films, this is considered, I believe, to be the best of the three.
Oh, one last thing before. Oh my God, I'm such an
Go ahead.
idiot. Before we move on, I forgot to mention my favorite line from The Company of Wolves, which is Angela Lansbury says, "Never eat a windfall apple, and never trust a man whose eyebrows meet."
Meet.
I love
Yeah,
that line.
I
I
have
love
that
that.
note about the never trust a man with whose eyebrows meet.
I love that. I love that. I just forgot to mention that, and I thought that was a great line. I too shall follow that rule. But Rappin' was I had never seen this as a kid or anything. I
I hadn't
never
either.
you had
I had not. This was my first viewing of it.
me too. And for those keeping track, Joel Silberg, he'd work with Canon Films before. He had done what did he do? He did Breaking One. He didn't do part two. He did this rapping, and then he eventually in 1990 he did Lambada. So that'll take us this I think Lambada will be another spiritual sequel to Breaking as well. It'll be like the part four of what I call the Breaking series, right?
And I think there's another one. I think there's, let me check, and I believe there's one called Beat Street that I'm not sure if that's a
If it's
canon
canon
film
film,
that's somewhere in the mix. Well,
So, here's
I don't
some.
think it's a canon.
It's I don't yeah I don't think it's a canon film. I don't remember seeing it on the list. But Rappin', here's some of
Okay, no.
the cast of Rappin'. It's Mario Van Peebles as the lead, John Hood, Eric LaSalle as Ice. It's funny because Ice Ice-T's in this film too. He has a cameo, and most of the, not most, all of the rapping that Mario Van Peebles does is was dubbed over by Ice-T, because apparently Mario Van Peebles was horrible at rapping, so they had to bring in Ice-T to kind of do the rapping bits for Mario Van Peebles. But it stars Mario Van Peebles, Eric LaSalle, Kadeem Hardison, who's from A Different World, I think, and The Cosby Show.
I think, yeah, and right? I have to note, it stars future TV stars, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Again, this follows the great, and we've seen this a lot in all the Ken film series, and also a lot of films from the 80s, where you had the multicultural gang.
Yes, the Will Smith from the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema podcast refers to it as United Colors of Benetton gang.
Yes, yes. So there's John Hood's gang, which is Eric LaSalle. So it's John Hood, Ice, Fats, and Richie. Mm-hmm. And then you have like the dueling gang, who's led by Dwayne, played by Charles Grant. Yeah, did you like this film? I just need to
no,
know.
No, I didn't. I have a few good things to say about it, but yeah. Overall, I did not enjoy this film.
I don't have a lot of good things to say about it. There's some funny scenes.
Yeah.
that definitely was like, all right, these two funny scenes, definitely worth the watch. But
okay,
just because they were two funny-ass jokes. I don't think they were jokes at the time, but they were funny to me. But overall, like, this movie, again, was really hard to watch. Just like Breaking 2, yep. Man, did I have a hard time paying attention. I had to watch this. I left this for as my last movie, because when we first decided to do this list, when we agreed upon these films, mm-hmm. I tried watching it. It's on YouTube in its entirety, and I tried watching the beginning, and it was hard. So I said, you know what, I'm going to leave this for the end, and I totally forgot about it, and I ended up watching it literally like 2 hours before we started this podcast. So it's fresh on my mind. It was hard to get through. It was hard not to just check Facebook and Twitter while I was watching this movie. It
well,
was difficult.
I did definitely do that watching this movie. So let me say what the good things are. The credit sequence is a pretty solid 70s urban film kind of sequence.
Yeah.
And actually watching the credits, I had some hope that this was actually going to be a lot more interesting than it was.
Yeah, I did too. I was hoping that it wouldn't be Breaking 3, which it was,
yeah.
You know?
But so, yeah, the credit sequence was, just watch the credit sequence. I thought that it had echoes of, like, The Mac and, like I said, just solid, like, 70s urban, guy gets out of jail and what's he going to do with the rest of his life kind of movie making. You know, the action had a lot of 80s look, which is kind of fun. And, you know, you get the club scene with the dance off.
Yeah.
And there's things at the time, like the milk cartons with pictures on them that
you
kind of, you know, that time has passed. But a lot of us can remember that. I like the fact that the rapping, which isn't good, but I like the fact that a lot of it's kind of silly, and there's a food rap in there. There's a rap about food. It's kind of fun. It kind of just reminded me that once upon a time, that was okay for rap music to be kind of silly and fun.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Accessible. You know, a lot of this felt like a rap video, like not like we think of a rap video, but a rap video circa 85. I did really like seeing at least parts of Pittsburgh in that time. Once again, for me, a lot of these films, I find that, you know, the older I get, being able to see what America and middle America especially looked like during my youth, really, it's some nostalgia, but it's also that validation that, yes, once upon a time, there was this culture that has largely vanished, and a lot of people didn't notice it going.
Yeah.
There was a kind of a, you know, we were talking about this as the Save the Rec Center, but the Save the Neighborhood. So there was dealing with some issues of gentrification, which was something that became a really big urban issue around this time going forward. You know, they could have done some lot more interesting things with it, but they didn't.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree. Like, I'm like, okay, I see where this is going, and you had the... the white businessman trying to move in on this neighborhood and kick everybody out. And I'm like, all right, let's see where this is going. And it quickly just turned into Breaking Three, the musical. The musical numbers weren't that great, but the most interesting number that I saw was the young kid. He was rapping before John Hood shows up. It's 12 years. It's like he can't be older than 12 years old, and he's rapping to this another younger girl who looks like she's 11 about staying with him. He's rapping to her like this romantic song about. I think the song's called "Stay With Me, Honey." And it was really weird, but really funny at the same time. But yeah, what else did you like about it?
That was really it. I mean, like I said, there wasn't a lot, and I didn't really care for the film, but just those few things.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm thinking that it would be nice if somebody could edit this film down to just those moments, or make one of those fake trailers that tells you the whole plot, but gives you the highlights.
Yeah, yeah. I'd watch that.
Honestly, I could see a bunch of 12-year-old girls at a sleepover having this on in the background, and conversely, I could see a bunch of people my age, people in their 40s, watching this at a party as kind of a nostalgia thing. A bunch of people that watched this growing up, putting it on in the background at a barbecue or something.
Yeah, yeah. Put it on in the background while you're having a dinner party or something.
Yeah.
Here are some of my favorite scenes, which were just amazingly funny. So Dwayne really wants, so John Hood just got out of jail. In the beginning of the film, he's getting out of jail. He's going back home. He went to jail cause he got in a fight and he killed a man. Right.
Yeah.
And his thing is he doesn't want to fight again. He doesn't want to fight ever again. You know, his mitts are lethal weapons, so he doesn't want to fight. And throughout the whole movie, Dwayne just wants to fight with him because Dwayne is kind of with the girl he likes, do they specify if he used to be with her? I don't think so, right? He's just a girl he used to like, right?
Yeah, I didn't. The movie was so unengaging in a lot of ways. I didn't even really pick up on exactly what the ties were. Yeah.
And so it's either like he had a thing for her and then he went to jail and she's now with Dwayne, but she works at a record label, she works as an assistant to this record producer and stuff. But Dwayne is her boyfriend, and he's always trying to pick a fight. And they're at this like dance club, and John Hood, Dwayne wants to fight, and he's like, I'm not gonna fight. And he leaves, and that's when he really finds out that this girl is with this guy. He goes to the bathroom, and he's really upset. He punches the wall, and then he turns around and punches the stall. I think he kicks it as well. He kicks a stall, and there's a young man going to the bathroom. He's not standing up, so he's not peeing. He was sitting down. And the guy goes, "Hey, what's wrong with you?" And if that were me, I'd be very fucking upset. I would have punched John Hood in the face. Kind of like, what the hell are you doing, man? I'm literally just trying to use the bathroom. You kicked the stall open. What's going on? But my favorite thing is that the guy in the bathroom gets totally upset, grabs his pants, pulls him up, and walks out of the bathroom. And
yep.
And then this is followed by one of the greatest things. I don't know what they were going for in this scene, but so the girl comes in and she sees that his hand's kind of like bloody because he had punched the wall, and she's trying to help him. And then Dwayne comes in and he's like, "What's going on here?" And he's like, "Nothing." And he's like, "No, no." And he's trying to pick a fight again. And and Martin Peebles says this. He yells. He looks at him and points at Dwayne, and he says, "Bathroom fool," and walks out. That's it. I don't know what they were going for. But he just yells at like full, like with a full, like he was going to punch him, but he used words and he said, "Bathroom fool," and he walks out. And I don't understand what that was, but I found it really funny. I wish I could make a GIF out of it or a meme. But that basically were my two favorite scenes. And then the musical number with the kids, "Stay With Me, Honey." Just creepy.
Yeah.
But yeah, his friends were kind of funny. They get Fats to eat a whole cake. That was pretty funny. And then the other funny scene was Dwayne is like Dwayne puts like his little brother in jail, puts John's little brother or cousin, I'm not sure what he is, in jail. And he says, all right, I have three things that I want you to know. And he uses cards to do it. So he brings up an ace and he's all, one, I want you to fight me, you know? Two, I want you to stay away from my lady, and brings out like the two diamonds. And I'm like, what's going on with these playing cards? This guy, like, did he see a Streetcar Named Desire? And he's like, well, Brando played with that glove, so I could play with playing cards. But that was the other funny scene I enjoyed. But besides that, man, again, this movie hard to get through. At least the Company of Wolves was artsy, and I got what they were going for. I didn't get what they were going for in this movie. It was purely to get the Breaking money, you know, like Breaking had done well. Breaking 2 hadn't done as well, you know, like it was kind of it found its money on video, because all these films were coming out when video was being VHS was starting to be available, and VHS rental houses were popping up everywhere in the U.S. So I think that's where they were aiming to get their money from, you know?
Yeah, and I remember that when Breaking 2 came out, you know, I was in elementary school, and I remember kids talking about that film, and I remember it being on the marquee of the movie theater that was in, you know, right next to our neighborhood that we drive by every week going to the grocery store. But I don't remember anything about this film. Yeah. I don't remember any kind of commercials for it on TV. I don't remember it playing anywhere.
Yeah. It was definitely hard to get through, but I think that was the worst of this group. Breaking was definitely the worst of these four films that we're covering. So what did you give it as a Letterboxd score?
I gave it 1.5 stars.
You are amazingly generous. I only gave it...
I realize that I can be fairly generous. Hey, you know what? It was in focus. The soundtrack was, you know, the levels were all correct. The, you know, that opening credit sequence I kind of liked.
Hey, they filmed the movie. They completed a movie and released it.
Yes.
Good for them.
Yeah.
So. Again, you're always generous, but I like that about you, that I feel like I'm more harsh, but that's what makes this good, that you know, I'm kind of the dick of the group. I give it a harsh rating. I like that you're more kind in films.
I have seen no star films, and this is definitely not one of them. So,
No, you know what? You do make a point. This is not, but for me, definitely a half a star. But I've seen no star films. You're right. This isn't a no star film. So I will give it. You know what? No. If I could go three quarters, I would. But I can't. So I'm going to go half a star. Half a star. I'm unwrapping. And what did I say? 2 stars for The Company of Wolves.
Yeah.
All right. Any last thoughts on Breaking?
Well, I think that this was probably the end of this particular trend and of rap films for canon. Looking at the list, I don't see any more coming up. I think that they saw the diminishing returns and decided to move on to other things. Probably also half this cast and the people they were casting these films started moving on to other kinds of work. So,
yeah. Well, I think the only similar film we have like this on this list of the canon films will be Lambada, which is kind of their dancing version of rapping and breaking.
Yeah, and that was kind of there was a couple of those films around that time where the Lambada came out that were all riffing on the popularity of this fad, basically this dance fad. So
yeah. All right. I think that those are my final thoughts. Just that, man, it was hard to get through. And, with that, bathroom fool, that's it for this one. Half a star for me. And that will lead us to, 1985's Life Force. And originally titled, The Space Vampires. That was the original working title of the film. I think that was also Colin Wilson's novel's title. So this movie is based on a novel, The Space Vampires by Colin Wilson. But I think by the time this movie came out, I think they wanted to get away from it being horror and more. They wanted the public to perceive it as a sci-fi film opposed to a horror film. So they retitled it Life Force. This is definitely an interesting movie. Life Force, again, from 1985, directed by Tobe Hooper, right?
Yep, who did Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
And Poltergeist.
Poltergeist, yeah. Those are the two films. In fact, those are the two films he did before this film.
Yes.
And so he had some
success.
Success before this film. And then the movie was written by Dan O'Bannon.
And I'm going to stop you right there because I need to talk about Dan O'Bannon.
Stop me. Talk about him.
Okay, so Dan O'Bannon worked with John Carpenter on his first film, Dark Star.
Yeah.
And then he wrote Alien and worked with H.R. Giger. And before we started recording, I was talking about what's probably my favorite documentary of the year so far, Jodorowsky's Dune. And one of the interesting things about Jodorowsky's Dune, and for those who don't know, Alejandro Jodorowsky he's still alive, is a cult filmmaker who made midnight movies in the early 70s. He made Holy Mountain and El Topo, which are just complete head trips.
Yes.
He was going to make Dune in the 1970s, and 1975 to be exact, and he went looking for his collaborators, and Mobius, the Spanish science fiction comic artist, was one of his early people that he found. And when they went, I'm not going to go through the whole thing about how they storyboarded and everything. Anyways, Jodorowsky went to Hollywood looking for somebody to do special effects. And they met with the most prominent special effects guy in Hollywood at the time, and he basically blew them off. And so they went and they stumbled around Hollywood, and they stumbled on a screening of Dark Star. And from there, Jodorowsky picked up Dan O'Bannon to do the effects for Dune. And then they brought Giger on to do design work, and that's where O'Bannon and Giger first crossed paths, and that's what led to them working together in Alien. And Dan O'Bannon then went on to direct one of my all-time favorite films, Return of the Living Dead, and then obviously wrote this.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things I noticed, I had seen this movie before, one of the things I noticed this time was the definite ties between Return of the Living Dead and this film as far as some of the themes and scenes that were similar.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I did notice that. It's funny because before I start the movies that I haven't watched, I definitely do the research before, like do all the trivia and like all the notes on the film before I start the movie, just so I know what to look for when I watch the movie. And I definitely read this, and I could. If I were describing this film to anybody else who hadn't seen it, I'd describe it as Alien meets Night of the Living Dead. That's what I would describe it as, the Return of the Night of the Living Dead. But you definitely see those tones that you mentioned. It starts off a little alien-y, and then it turns into this weird vampire/zombie horror film. So you want to give us a little synopsis of the movie?
Sure. So there's a joint space mission to Halley's Comet, and in the comet they find a ship, and this is where the alien part comes in, and they have some kind of contact with the ship, and they find three bodies that are in suspended animation.
They're humanoid bodies too.
What?
They're like humanoid. They look like humans.
Yes. Basically, the rest of the film is trying to figure out what's going on. Who are these humanoids that were found? The leader of the expedition to the Churchill, the space shuttle, turns up in an escape pod that lands in Texas, and he's brought to London to help piece together what had happened to the crew.
Yeah.
Of the space shuttle. And from there, it's trying to figure out who these humanoids are and what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And at the end, it kind of turns into this, like, Night of the Living Dead zombie apocalypse film. apocalyptic film. Yes. So let's start from the beginning. So they find these three bodies, one female and two male, and mm-hmm. they don't know if they're alive, dead. They're humanoid. We know that. And what's so fascinating is just like always, you could, the female who you never learn her name. She's just known as Space Girl. That's yeah. her character's name. Space Girl. So the three pods are strategically placed. So you can see all of the women. You can see her breasts, her genitalia, everything. The males, not so much.
Yep.
I'm like, that's oh man, it's the 80s. And apparently, reading through the notes and stuff, apparently Tobe Hooper's original cut was like way over 2 hours, and there's a lot of more extended scenes that were cut out of the movie that take place on the Churchill, and that contain a lot more violence and erotic footage, apparently. So I'd be curious to see what the hell they cut out, because it's pretty crazy as it is. So they find these three bodies, beautiful looking woman, two men. Mm-hmm. This was definitely my first viewing of this film. I had never seen it before. Yeah. You had, right? You said?
Yeah, I saw it back in the 80s, and it really didn't make much of an impression at that point. Yeah. In time.
What did you think of it now?
I really enjoyed it. I want to pick up the Blu-ray of this.
Yeah.
I'm a major Dan O'Bannon fan, so you know that connected with me exactly where it should have.
Yeah.
In that level.
I'll say this: when the film first starts and you see the space shuttle and the comet and all that stuff, the visual effects look a little hokey to me.
Yeah, and, well, they're up to time.
Yeah, and I thought, well, here's the thing: is that, I mean, this movie is 85. Alien came out when did Alien come out?
79. But you got to remember with Alien that we're talking about. And with Blade Runner, we're talking about Ridley Scott. We're talking about somebody that
it's got came a huge from world budget.
Commercials that has,
yeah.
you know, that has a bigger budget too. This is, I mean, this was a pretty big budget film, I'm sure, but it was probably a more mid range, an up kind of budget. It wasn't at the level that a Blade Runner, or an Alien, or that kind of thing would necessarily get.
No, it's true. But so seeing the opening of this film, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like this film. Mm-hmm. I don't know where this is going. But then when you start watching the practical effects, man, I was kind of blown away. Like this movie is definitely one of those movies where I'm like, okay, I better get my iPhone because I'm going to definitely be cruising Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And mm-hmm. literally as soon as he goes, so they bring back the bodies, they're studying them, and one of the scientists goes into the room where the female body's at, and she wakes up, and the scientist is wearing this like face mask to, you know, with oxygen, and she takes it off to kiss him, and as soon as like some of these effects start happening, man, I was like, all right, I'm hooked, because these practical effects were pretty amazing for their time and really blew me away. So this is where it starts getting really good. So she literally sucks the life out of him through this kiss. Mm-hmm. Literally, like, the life force is taken out. And there's a really cool Raiders of the Lost Ark type of, like, death scene where he basically turns into, like, a cadaver, you know?
Yes. Yep.
And that the scientist basically is dead. Another scientist shows up, and she tries to. We're not clear if he's tried to suck his life force out of him or not. She kind of starts to, and then it's this whole like chase to find them, and who they are and what they're here for, and. It definitely gets a little crazy, and the effect where that's the first scientist comes back, he's a cadaver, and he sits up and he sucks the others. Man, that kind of blew me away, and that was pretty scary. I'm sure it, at its time, it would have definitely scared some people, because really well done effects. That blew me away.
Yeah, and most definitely. I recall this being a fairly well thought of science fiction horror film at the time.
So besides the spaceship, you got to forgive those effects that were of the time, the visual effects. But once it gets to practical effects, man, they do an amazing job in this film. And the writing too, it wasn't hokey or anything. It kind of worked for what it was. And basically, what this movie boils down to is that it's space vampires. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Space vampires. It's very much like a well written, well done Ed Wood type film. Like it just a good popcorn film. I'm sure I would have loved it if I'd seen it back in the day. I would have loved it. Definitely some scary scenes. I wish if I'd seen this as a kid, I would definitely would have been scared. There's this whole scene where when they suck the force out of them, I call it the weird science effect, which is there's a lot of wind and a lot of like thunder and lightning. Sorry, not thunder, lightning. And there's a lot of wind, and I call it the weird science effect.
See, I actually have a note that's to me, there's like the lighting and shadows and the score and the use of the wind and the lightning is very much like kind of a universal monsters kind of a thing.
Yeah, now I see that. Yeah. It you know what it did? I remember and this also is reminiscent to Universal Monsters, but it gave me like a Monster Squad vibe to it.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. And then the there's original music by Henry Mancini, which is really good. I really enjoyed the score to this movie.
Well, there's a reason he was the master of the movie score for decades. I mean, yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Any other things that kind of popped up that
also on the Universal Monsters thing, the corpses kind of look like mummies.
Yeah,
which are definitely Universal Monsters.
Yeah.
The special ops guys in this are Special Air Services, which are basically the UK version of the Delta Force.
Yeah.
In fact, the Delta Force is based on SAS.
Yeah.
When the Delta Force was formed, they were based on the already existing SAS. You know, it's like Dracula in space, and there's a little bit of, you ever seen the movie The Hidden?
Yes.
Kind of like, there's a little bit of that going on in here. There's a redheaded woman at one point who's I believe she's a nurse, and there's a Ziggy Stardust poster in her her apartment that made me smile. And there's also some butterfly artwork that's kind of the image of something transforming.
Yeah.
So what else? The vampire zombie attack on London. I thought it was a little long and it's kind of cheap, but I thought it was effective. We're used to 28 Days Later, and this was maybe a little more like the 80s version of it.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Once he goes back for the, you know, at the end, he goes back into the city to kill the girl and the guy who's in love with the alien. He goes back in the city, and that devastation kind of impressed me because it was very great production value for all the zombie vampire bodies like all over the place, and that was good production value. I was thoroughly surprised, like wow, there's a ton of extras in the scene, and you know, great apocalyptic devastation in the film, and for its time, it kind of, even if they did that now, I'd say wow, that they spent some good money in those effects of the city and
I'm looking at the production details on the Blu-ray here, and it says that the special effects were done by John Dykstra, who did the special effects for Star Wars. The 1977 best visual effects for Star Wars. I mean, they had the A team on this.
Yeah. And then another thing that I really enjoyed was it was a surprise to see Patrick Stewart in this
in an early film role.
He has about 18 minutes of screen time, but he's pretty, this is a pretty funny scene. I mean, it's pretty
good. Yeah. Well, and he's a solid presence on screen as well.
Yeah. And it's funny because you could definitely, when it comes to these type of like, quote unquote, B movies, great acting definitely sticks out. Do you mean like, like just like bad acting sticks out in a good movie, good acting definitely sticks out in a bad movie. And just watching Patrick Stewart, he definitely sticks out as one of the best actors of that film.
Yes.
But this was pre a lot of things. He was in Dune, and this was post. Was it post Dune? It was pre Dune, right? 85. It was right after. It was 85. This was 85, and Dune was 84. So
yeah, this based on the release dates, yes. But who knows which order they were made in?
Yeah.
So, but basically the same time period.
Yeah. But definitely a great acting by Patrick Stewart. And like I said, great production value at the end. And so we should say that after all this devastation and stuff, one of the colonels figures out how to kill the vampires, which is basically how you kill every vampire, but just slightly different. It's literally you don't stab them through the heart; you stab them right, like, what is it, like 2 inches below the heart.
Yeah, where like their power source or whatever
their power core is at, and. And at the end, the man who had fallen in love with the original female vampire, he's the guy who saves the day. And at the end, it was kind of really open ended for a sequel or something, because at the end they're sucked back into the ship and the ship takes off. So I had to do some research to find out if there was a sequel plan or anything, but I found nothing in the notes or anything. So. But yeah, it was definitely open ended for a sequel, which they never made, I guess. So
yeah. Oh.
But yeah, the Space Girl is played by Matilda May, who's easy in the eyes, I'll say.
Oh yeah, that's this is what she's probably most known for, and most definitely. Yeah, she's a very, very beautiful woman.
Yeah. So definitely this was a good one for me. I actually yes. enjoyed it. My first viewing of it, I had never seen this before, and I it started off and I wasn't sure about the visual effects, but once those practical effects come in and just it's a fun story. It's they're starting to get into their bigger budget films. I think this and like Superman 4 were their biggest the movies with the biggest budget, I think.
Yeah.
But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I this one I would definitely recommend. It's basically vampires from space.
I definitely recommend it. And as I said, I'm planning to pick up the Blu-ray, Scream Factory Blu-ray at some point.
And so any notes before we get into the rating of this film?
The only thing I didn't mention was the old 1970s, early 80s Buck Rogers TV series actually had a space vampire episode that made me think of. In that, it was like cheap Star Wars wannabe television, but that's one of the more effective episodes of that series.
Yeah.
I think they got a lot of things right. Obviously, they got a lot of things right. And some of the big things and some of the little things.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think this Tobe Hooper's gotten a lot of crap for kind of riding on his, his big achievements. And I think he's a solid director of this, but I think that the script is, Dan O'Bannon's input is definitely the star for me.
Yeah. Like I said, definitely dug it. Definitely, I would describe this as Alien meets, the Return of the
Return of the Dead. Yeah. So what? What's your star rating?
I'm gonna go. This is 3.5 star for me.
Yeah, that's exactly what I have as well.
Yeah. Yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it. I would consider buying the Blu-ray. Enjoyed
definitely.
It. So those are our Letterboxd ratings. And that leaves us with one last film. One of my favorites. One of my all-time favorites. I would say this, if I was making a top 20 list, even like a top 15, this would probably make the list. And I'm talking about 1985's American Ninja. This I was excited to rewatch and to talk with you about. Let me get my notes for this now. American Ninja, like I said, 1985. It had the original title of American Warrior. The trailer has the title of, and even the first, I think the first posters. I think the first time I saw this poster, it said American Warrior on it. But eventually they changed the title to American Ninja. The poster, very iconic for me. I definitely, yeah. This stuck out a lot for me because basically the poster is an American flag and a ninja striking a pose and Michael Dudikoff in like army fatigue with a sword and they're fighting. Yeah. And very iconic for me. I love this movie. I don't think it's not nostalgic for me. I think I generally just enjoyed this film as a kid and I still enjoy it now. So basically stars Michael Dudikoff, Stephen James, and the quick little synopsis of this movie before we get into, you know, some serious ninja talk. Private Joe Armstrong, he's a private in the U.S. Army, and they're in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And basically, we don't know a lot about Joe Armstrong. You know, like he was found on the when they were built. I think when they were building the military base, he was found like in the jungle. And he's American. He's like, you know, he's a white male. So he kind of grew up in the kind of indoctrinated into the army very young, and they don't know a lot about him. Don't know where he's from, who his parents were from. He kind of lost his memory when, because they were blasting the jungle to build the army base, and they find him in the rubble. And later you find out in flashbacks that he was found in the rubble and he had like a head injury and he doesn't remember a lot about his past. So he doesn't know where he's from, who his parents are. He doesn't remember anything. So had you seen this film before?
I did see this back in the day, and I do not recall if it was on video or in the theater. I know it's one that was in the theater that I did want to see very much, and I did see it at a certain point.
Yeah. So this film, directed by Sam Fistenberg, who we've covered on this podcast, on this series. He directed Revenge of the Ninja, Ninja 3 The Domination. He directed Breaking 2. And then we'll eventually talk about him more because he directed Avenging Force, American Ninja 2, Delta Force 3, American Samurai, Cyborg Cop. He did a lot of work for...
he was one of their go-to directors.
Yeah. Seems like. Yeah, he was. And even the script was written by three guys, but it was... he brought in James Silke, who had worked with him on Revenge of the Ninja and Ninja 3 The Domination. Mm-hmm. And what I hear, how this movie came about was that in its original release, Ninja 3 The Domination, which we covered in our previous episode, which we love, Eric and I love, mm-hmm. Didn't great. Do well in the box office as much as their other ninja films had done. And so they realized that the big thing that people were complaining about was that the lead ninja was a female ninja in Ninja 3. So for this one, they wanted to go with an all-American, like Golan was very clear that he wanted an all-American James Dean type to be the lead. And they saw a bunch of people for the role. And they finally settled on Michael Dudikoff because he does kind of have like a very like quiet kind of James Dean look to him. There's Joe Armstrong, Michael Dudikoff's character, doesn't do a lot of talking in the film. And
I noticed that he doesn't speak for the first, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah. Very stoic. And even when the lead female, Patricia, the love interest, when she's talking to him, he's very like shy. It is a very much a James Dean type performance. Yeah.
There's also allusions to John Wayne. Yes. John Wayne is mentioned and is actually in one scene as a picture of John Wayne.
Yes. So Joe Armstrong, the character played by Michael Dudikoff, he's very much a stoic James Dean type. And when they cast Michael Dudikoff, he didn't know any martial arts. So they cast the actor, then they had to train him. So, which I was surprised because he did okay. I mean, I'm sure when he's in the ninja suit, it's a stunt double, but you know, he did okay for what he had to do. In fact, in some of the scenes, he they did a really smart thing, which was they take off his mask at one point in one of the final some of the final battles, and it helps because ninjas are always dressed in black, you know, and it's hard to keep track of who's who when they all look alike.
We get all the different colored ninja uniforms during the training scene.
It's true. It's true. And Jorun Frank does wear a red sash around his waist, so that kind of helps. But I dig that he took his mask off to fight at the end. So this film also stars Judy Aronson, who, for people who don't know, she starred in Weird Science, and that the Weird Science she did literally right before she did this. So it was Weird Science was her previous film. She's a really attractive girl. I remember when I saw Weird Science, I had a huge crush on her as a kid. Huge crush.
Yeah.
And she did Weird Science, and then she immediately did this film. And I even had to check up on who was the casting director, because what is it? Steve James is also, he has a cameo in Weird Science, and he's also one of the leads in this.
Yeah, and going back to the Judy Aronson for one moment, I always was thinking that it was actually Mariska Hargitay who was playing this role for the longest time.
Really?
Yeah, because that's who I remember from when I was a kid, but obviously I was wrong. And she was in one of the Friday the 13th. That's the other thing she's really known for.
Yes, you're right. You're totally right. But for me, she really definitely stuck out because I definitely had a huge crush on her because of Weird Science. She was a girl that Wyatt was in love with.
So for me, that would have been Amanda Peterson, no relation, obviously, in Can't Buy Me Love, that I had the massive crush on.
Would you say from Can't Buy Me Love?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
That movie's so good. Sorry. All right.
She stars as a female lead, and she's the colonel's daughter, and they're in the Philippines. And so let's start the movie. So the movie starts off, and Joe Armstrong, it's funny because I watched this with a friend who hadn't seen this film before.
Okay.
And I literally watched it maybe like a month ago. Mm-hmm. And then literally last night, my friend and I were hanging out, and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to rewatch American Ninja because I love that movie. And I put it on, and he's like, oh, I've never seen this, and I keep hearing you talk about it. And the movie starts off, and they're waiting for the colonel's daughter to come out, and they're going to transfer them. And so they're taking her home, and they're taking a bunch of trucks with a ton of weapons. Yeah. And they're going, you know, they're taking the streets of the Philippines to get to transport these weapons and the colonel's daughter. And Joe Armstrong is one of the drivers of the trucks. And all the other soldiers are playing hacky sack. And the driver, the colonel's daughter's Patricia, the character of Patricia, her driver is also like in the game of hacky sack. And like 5 minutes in, and they throw the hacky sack right near Joe Armstrong's face. And they're like, hey, can you throw it back? And he won't throw it back. And so the driver has to go and pick it up, and he calls him an asshole and stuff. And my friend's like, wow, 5 minutes in, and all this movie is about a dick who won't play hacky sack.
Well, the thing that got me is, because I watched this yesterday as well, is hacky sack was huge back in the 80s. I remember my weird little high school, people were playing hacky sack all the time outside the building. And so to see it in this film, it was like, my first note is, hacky sack and butterfly knives.
Yes, because he's playing with a butterfly knife as he's pouting and emoting.
Yep, and standing right there by the truck.
Yeah, and kind of he's got his right foot on the truck. You know how when you have one foot on the floor and one foot on the truck.
I wonder if that's a James Dean illusion. Doesn't he do that in the poster for
Rebel Without a Cause?
Yeah,
he does. He has like his leg up, and then he's got like the cigarette in one hand. And it was very reminiscent of James Dean. I feel like Golem was like, you have to have the James Dean scene. Like,
yes.
And it was totally like just ripped off of Rebel Without a Cause. But the movie starts off, and the first thing, the impression you get is it's just a dick who won't play hacky sack.
Yeah. And won't be part of the team.
Yeah. He's not a team player. He's just pouts and he's kind of a dick. And then so they're transporting, they're driving through kind of these isolated roads, and they're doing some construction on the road. So the construction worker stops them, and this like group of guerrilla fucking like fighters attack them.
Yeah, guerrillas.
Yeah. And the first thing I thought was, why don't American soldiers have weapons in this movie? Like all the guerrilla, all this militia that attacks them, they don't have weapons. What's the deal with that? Like why?
Well, and we come to find out that this isn't the first time that one of their transport
has been hijacked,
been attacked.
Yeah, and they still don't have weapons. The American soldiers don't have weapons.
Totally. It's like, don't you have an infantry brigade or something there that's gonna?
And guess what?
You know,
you're transporting weapons.
Yeah. Well, you don't have an unarmed transport caravan. You don't have a movie. So.
Exactly. So they have this unarmed transport, and some of the lead kidnap. Do you feel like they're going to kidnap Patricia? I feel like she's being difficult.
You have that moment that's like, they're going to kidnap her, they're going to rape her, they're going to kill her. What's going on?
Yeah,
here?
You don't know what's going to happen with her. But they pull her out of the car, and the driver as well, and the second in command, who eventually you find out is in cahoots with the ninjas. I forget his character's name, but I think he's not the colonel. He's like the sergeant or something, you know?
Yeah.
And so they pull him out, and she's Patricia's in the back seat, and they pull her out. And by the way, for dealing with people who have guns, she's kind of a bitch to them. Like I'm like, whoa! Like, why don't you just be cool and do what they say? Because they're gonna kill you. They have guns. They're pointing guns in your face.
Well, she comes off as a snotty LA rich kid.
Yes.
Which, you know, fine, yes. Which is kind of what the character is.
Yeah, totally. And so she's kind of like snobby, and she's talking back to these guys, and they start roughing her up. They backhand her, you know? And Joe Armstrong doesn't like this one bit, you know? And Joe Armstrong goes up there and just punches both those guys out. Mm-hmm. And all the American soldiers see, like, hey, this guy's going for it. So they start attacking back. And they take control of the situation. They take away the weapons from these guys, and yep. Now they're in control. And one of the what I noticed, man, this movie is filled with horrible drivers. In the jungle, you know, hidden in the jungle, you see these ninjas, and they come out of nowhere and they start attacking now the American soldiers. And at no point do the American soldiers ever shoot. Like around, like they don't use the weapons at all. They have automatic weapons, and they don't shoot the ninjas.
Well, we do find out later on that they were ordered to not resist and not cause any kind of an incident.
Yeah, but so the ninjas attack, and the ninjas are going to take control of these weapons stuff, and Patricia gets in the car and starts driving off. I don't know how she loses control. She's just the world's worst driver, but she loses control.
Yeah.
And she gets out of the car. Joe Armstrong's nearby. And this is where you start seeing, like the hints that there's something different about Joe Armstrong, is that the ninjas throw arrows at the girl. And Joe catches the arrows with a wooden shovel. He literally like just puts the wooden shovel in front of Patricia's face, and the arrows go both the arrows go into the wooden shovel, which is a pretty cool move. I always dug that. I was like, like he didn't choose to use the metal part of the thing to, you know, swat them. He literally just caught them with the skinny part of the wooden handle, you know? I thought that was really cool. And then the head ninja, you know, he's really impressed, you know, and he asks the second in command, the sergeant, he's all, who is this man? He possesses great powers, you know, and he's really intrigued by this American soldier. I could go all day about this movie, but basically, he takes her into the jungle. They're trying to escape the ninjas. They have a moment where they jump in the river. They have to get out and dry out. The ninjas, first of all, the most inept ninjas in the world. They can't keep track of these people. They can't, you know, catch their scent. They're supposed to be these great warriors. Can't find a teenager and an American soldier, you know?
Yeah.
They get out of the river, and the ninjas are gone, and they're drying off. And the way that you dry off in the hot as hell jungle is by taking off your clothes. So Joe Armstrong suggests they take off their clothes. The next scene is they're taking off their clothes and they literally just took them off. Mm-hmm. And she's talking about, like, she wants to know more about him. And like, oh, if she says, if my father knew about, you know, if my father saw us here, he, you know, he shit a brick and all this stuff. And he immediately gets really, really, like self-conscious and really like weird. And he's like, well, we should leave. We should put our clothes on. They're dry now. And it's like, how did they dry out in like 30 seconds?
And she is totally checking him out.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Usually in the film, it would be the other way around. He's not even looking at her, but she is totally checking him out.
He has his back towards her. That's how much of a gentleman he is. She's kind of snobby. And I like the fact that she's wearing heels. And when they're walking through the jungle, he takes off her shoes and he just like karate chops the heels off.
Yes.
Love that.
She starts complaining about it, which is exactly what a young woman of her status in that day and time would have done.
Yeah. And then Joe, she's wearing a skirt and Joe takes his butterfly knife, which is badass. And mm-hmm. and like it looks like he's going to stab her crotch, but doesn't. he rips her skirt apart to make the skirt into shorts so she can run faster.
And she's more concerned with the damage to her clothing than any kind of potential assault.
Forget these assassins that are following us. I'm thoroughly upset with you messing up my pumps, and you owe me money for these pumps. She even exclaims. So these are the worst ninjas ever. They lose track of them. Joe eventually gets her to her house safely, and he goes back to the base. And he gets reprimanded, you know, even though he just saved the colonel's daughter, still gets reprimanded.
You know, you try to be a gentleman, you can never win.
Yeah, no, never. You know, everyone's like blaming him for because a couple people died. A couple people were killed by ninjas mm-hmm. back at the convoy. So Steve James, his character is Captain Curtis Jackson or Corporal. Curtis Jackson, and he doesn't take any guff from anybody. You know, he's like a tough guy, and he's mad at Joe. He's like, "Hey, you trying to be a tough guy, and you got some of our guys killed." And he tries to make an example out of Joe, and like, you know, he tries to kick his ass, but Joe does something badass. He puts a bucket over his face, and says, "I'm gonna fight you with this bucket on my face." And that's how great. That's where you start to see his ninja skills come about. You know,
that's also very. Kind of a, I don't want to say Kurosawa, but kind of a very, you know, actually Japanese, you know, ninja swordsman kind of film move. I mean, that's actually my thought was the training scene in Star Wars.
Yeah, totally. And with his bucket over his face, Joe just beats the shit out of Jackson. Mm-hmm. And at the end, like, it's weird. It's one of those things where it's like, it's one of those like Cool Hand Luke moments where it's like, hey man, now I beat the shit out of you or you beat the shit out of me and we're friends for it. You know? Like, like we respect each other cause you know how to fight. So then, Jackson and him become friends. And then, you know, one of the corporals or one of the other, heads, they see this commotion, this fight, and they reprimand Joe and not Jackson, you know? But they become friends, and you know, he's kind of in love with Patricia, and
she's interested in him.
Yeah, she's interested, and this is where you meet is it Victor Ortega, who is the French villain of the film?
Yeah,
and you know you're badass when you have under your employment an army of ninjas. That's how you know you've made it as a bad guy.
And it's led by the Black Star Ninja, who was the ultimate ninja.
Yeah. So you have the Black Star Ninja who has like this, he has this black star over his eye. Mm-hmm. And he leads the army of ninjas for this Frenchman. And I love that the villain's always foreign, you know? But this movie, I'm telling you, this is a fun movie. I don't want to spoil too much, but eventually Joe gets his memory back. He realizes he meets his sensei or Shidoshi, you know? And he's a gardener for the villain, for the Frenchman, for Ortega. And he's just this like lonely gardener, you know, that fixes, you know, the water lilies and all this stuff. And you find out that he's the guy who trained Joe as a kid. He found him in the jungle, like he had gotten lost or his parents were killed. It wasn't very clear what happened there.
Yeah.
But he kind of raised them and trained them as a ninja. And then when they were blowing up the jungle, he kind of lost his memory and forgot about this. But his master shows him, I don't know what he does. He basically is showing him his, what is it called? Is it mantra? No, not a mantra. What is it? What am I thinking?
No, he's showing them the forms.
The kata. The kata, I think it's called.
Yeah, the kata.
And through the kata, he goes back in his mind and realizes that, oh, wow, this guy trained me and I'm a ninja and I have the training. And basically he kind of saves the day, you know, and him and Jackson kind of storm in. Jackson storms in with some more troops and they save the day. But some good ninja fight scenes. At one point, the Black Star Ninja, or I don't know if it's Black Star Ninja, but a couple ninjas. Joe's in the what is it, the jail? The military police arrest him, and the ninjas go in there. Yeah, and they try to kill him, and Joe's hiding under the bed because he knows they're after him. But man, I'm telling you, this movie, it's still fun for me. Like I love rewatching it. I've watched it twice before we recorded this episode. Like I said. I just enjoy this movie. Great film.
It is a lot of fun. So, yes.
And I'm gonna say it. I give it 4 stars because I love this movie. What did you give it?
I gave it 3.5.
See, now you're not being kind to ninjas.
No, I thought it was. I enjoyed it a lot. I think it's good. I think that the plot is a little basic, which is fine. There's no reason not to give it 4 stars if you enjoy it that much. Yeah. And I did enjoy it quite a bit. So I, you know, 3.5 is what I thought works for it. I thought that some of the stuff you pointed out about like the, you know, there being no guards on the transport column and all that kind of stuff. I thought, I don't know. My mind started to wander at certain points, and this is my question to you. Now, Steve James, we didn't talk about a lot.
Yeah.
He's charismatic. He actually knew all the martial arts stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like a total badass. Unfortunately, he passed away young, and just as he was maybe about to get his huge break. I mean, he was in a lot of movies that people know.
Yeah.
He was one of those character actors. I was sitting there thinking, what if they had had the courage to have him be the star?
That would have been really interesting. And here's the thing. This is why he's not the star. Because he's black. That's the main reason. And it's sad to say, because he was a much better actor than Michael Dudikoff.
Yeah.
And he was a much better. He was an actual good fighter. Like he had the look, the stance. He was just a great fighter. Maybe they're like, Steve, you got to shave your mustache to be in the movie. And he's like, I don't shave my mustache for anybody.
I think that I'd heard that you know Michael Dudikoff and him worked together. I think 3 or 4 times on films, and eventually I think there was some tensions because you know Steve James is the better actor. He was the better fighter. He was the better stuntman. And he's playing second fiddle in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, they pull off the buddy thing, but you can, at least I could still, and maybe knowing that, I could still sense just a little bit of tension.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's good, and that leads to kind of a healthy competition, but I don't know. I mean, that was just the little thing that for me actually knocked it from the 4 to 3.5 stars was. And I wish Steve James had more screen time, quite frankly.
No, yeah, I that's one thing I totally agree with you. And his scenes are great. It, like the buddy scenes with him and Michael Dudikoff, they're really great. And they're even showcased a little more in American Ninja 2. He really becomes more of a lead in part 2, I feel.
Yeah, and I think that obviously that after this film came out that somebody realized that hey, these two characters have a future.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I did like Judy Arnson a lot. She has a lot of spunk and she has a lot of charisma on screen. And it's not just that she's cute, which she is, but she's not like stunning. I mean, we're not talking like, I'm sure she probably could have done some modeling, but she wasn't going to be like the Victoria's Secret model or anything.
No, she looked like a normal woman. She looked like your typical woman, like American woman.
I liked her. I just thought maybe she could have been used a little bit better. And you know, I think that the big thing was the plot that kind of held me back from giving it another half a star. So
Here's the thing about Steve James is you're right. Like right as he was kind of getting he had a big break with these films, but right when he was going mainstream, like with, you know, really popular films, mm-hmm. He got pancreatic cancer like in 1993.
And you know that he was slated to star in that Sam Raimi TV series Mantis.
Really?
Yeah, he was cast in that and had to drop out because of his illness.
Oh man. That would have been, and I know that's why he didn't also participate in American Ninja 4. I would have enjoyed seeing him. So to explain the rest of this series is a fun series for me, except for American Ninja 3. We have the series starts off with this one, American Ninja 1, and then American Ninja 2. I think they're in like Hawaii. I don't know why there's always there's ninjas wherever they go.
Because ninjas are everywhere. That's why.
Yeah, they're everywhere in the world. So you have American Ninja 1 that came out in 85.
Yeah.
And then you have American Ninja 2, the Confrontation, that came out in 87. That one again stars Steve James and Michael Dudikoff as the leads. Then you have American Ninja 3, Blood Hunt. And this is the Tokyo Drift of the American Ninjas. This is where Michael Dudikoff said, you know what, I'm bowing out. You're not paying me enough. I'm out. And for that, they brought in another actor to play the American Ninja. Not the same character, but a different character. They brought in David Bradley. But they kept Steve James in the movie.
Yeah.
So it was Steve James and David Bradley playing, not playing Joe Armstrong, playing a different character called Sean Davidson. And then they also did American Ninja 4, which I liked actually. American Ninja 4, The Annihilation, and that one brought back together Michael Dudikoff and David Bradley in the same movie. So they were teaming up, and they were gonna bring in Steve James to be the third lead, but sadly he had already he had gotten ill and he couldn't participate in the movie. But we'll be talking about the rest of these films throughout the series because they're all canon film produced.
Yeah, and I actually never saw the sequels, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Then you may be in for a treat, my friend. I love this series. The only one the only one I hate is part 3. To be honest, I didn't like when they got rid of Michael Dudikoff. But then he came back for 4, and I was good again. So this movie, like I said, I enjoyed it. I know there's a bunch of plot holes and stuff, but for me, like the first, I would say I might have seen this before I saw Ninja 3 and such, and like Revenge of the Ninja. So for me, like this was kind of like this was my introduction to ninjas, and like as a kid, I mean, I was born in 81, so to me, like this was like the introduction to ninjas. I went through a huge phase where all I wanted to see was ninja movies. So this was what introduced me to the ninjas, and that's why it holds a special place in my heart. But overall, like I just enjoy the movie itself. Like it's fun for me. That's why I give it 4 stars. But you should definitely check it out. It's fun, and like I said, just alone for the Steve James scenes, he's really great in this. I wish he would have gotten a break more in serious films because he was a good actor. Just period. Not a good action star, but a genuinely good actor.
Yeah, and he had charisma, and there's a film that he had a small cameo role in, basically called Big Shots, where he is the these two boys go looking for their missing father, and he's the missing father. And so I mean, he did a lot of that kind of stuff, and he worked with John Sayles, and he did all kinds of interesting work. You're right, he was in Weird Science, he was in To Live and Die in L.A., he was in Hollywood Shuffle. I mean, he had a certain amount of comedic timing.
Yeah, yeah. He was he's in one of the funny scenes in Weird Science. He's in the scene where they're at the bar, and yeah, the Malacca scene, which I call. So I definitely like I said, I gave it 4 stars. Eric, you gave it 3.5.
Yep, and I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, so check it out. And like I said, we will be continuing our Canon series and the American Ninja series, because there's 4 of them. Actually, there's 5. But I disavowed the 5th one because it was horrible. And again, David Bradley was the lead of it. I think actually Pat Morita is in the 5th one.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so that really strayed from the series. But like I said, we'll be covering these.
And I'm not sure that that 5th one was a Canon film either.
I think, it is. It's one of their last ones. Oh. It came out in 1993. Okay. The last film they did, the Canon film series did, was American Cyborg, Steel Warrior. And the second to last was American Ninja 5.
American Ninja 5. So. Okay, yeah. I see that now.
All right. So, yeah, that concludes these 4 films. I hope you kind of got something out of it. I am enjoying these films starting from this group of films. Like I said, I had never seen Life Force. Enjoyed it. American Ninja, one of my favorites of all time, I would say. But this starts our trend in like really fun, good 80s action films and such. We're going to be covering, let's see, next we got like, we have a great movie, Runaway Train, which I love. I think that we might be covering on our next.
You want to do that episode. One next? Right, so the next one after American Ninja was Mata Hari.
Yeah.
You want to do that one?
I think it's going to be hard to find, but we'll try to find that one.
I think actually, I think my Netflix queue. So we'll take a look for that. Mata Hari. And then Invasion USA.
Yeah. Death Wish 3. Yeah.
King Solomon's Mines.
Yeah. And we'll end with Runaway Train. Yep. And the one I recommend the most, and which my father actually introduced me to Runaway Train, because he was a big fan of Eric Roberts and John Voight. But this is a really great film. This one I would suggest, if you watch one film out of this group coming up, it's this one, Runaway Train. I love. It's stars Eric Roberts, John Voight, Rebecca De Mornay. But yeah, we get some great films coming up. Like I said, that this episode starts the series of like, where they get really good. Like we have some, we have 52 Pickup eventually that we're going to do, mm-hmm. which I love. Firewalker. We're going to do Cobra, Barfly. There's some gems in here that are coming up. So stay tuned, man. Our list is, we got a couple episodes left of this series. Cause
for sure.
But stay tuned.
Keep on going.
Yeah. Follow us on Twitter at The Film Podcast. Follow our website at thefilmpodcast.com. Pretty soon, I think in a month or so, we're going to be eventually merging into a bigger website. It's going to be called Watch, Look, Listen. And we're going to have a bunch of stuff. We're going to have Eric on there talking maybe about music. Maybe get Morris also on there, maybe, helping us out. But we're going to be talking about music, TV, films, and we're going to be doing a little bit of local LA stuff, like bars and stuff, restaurants to go to. So it's going to be a little bit of everything on there. So check that out. I'll tweet out when that goes live. But yeah, you can follow Eric. Where could people follow you on Twitter? What's your handle?
It's at IRENZERO, Iron Zero.
And you can find me at Ricardo, ULTRERES, on Twitter. But like I said, all our stuff, all our links will be on thefilmpodcast.com. Just click on the tab that says The Gang, and you'll see Eric and my name.
Yeah.
And that has a link to everything, to our letterbox, to our Twitter, everything. So if you want to tweet us or send us an email, you can send it there, or just tweet us, direct message us or whatever. All right. For myself and Eric, guys, we always enjoy you guys listening, and any comments or, I invite people, if you're a big fan of the Canon film series, hey, tweet us, and give us some of your thoughts on some of these films and such. And, we'll read them out, on the next episode and such. So until next time. Yeah. And check out that stuff we mentioned in the beginning. Check out, Bob Freelander, Brian Sauer's podcast that he's on now, Screamcast. check out that documentary we talked about, Electric Boogaloo. It's going to be really fun. Mm-hmm. Hopefully there's a trailer soon. I haven't seen a trailer for it yet.
Yeah, I haven't either.
But the poster is up, and I hope they release that special edition VHS. Because if they release in VHS, I'm going to love it. I'll buy that edition too. So check that out, and also check out the documentary. What is it called again? The Dune documentary?
Jodorowsky's Dune.
Check that out. It's on the man right now.
Yeah, and it just came out on Blu-ray and DVD.
Yeah, so check those out. Follow us, and thanks for listening, guys. Until next time, have a good week.